And today, this is our final program of this, our second week. I won't keep doing that because I think as we accumulate more programs, we don't want to assign them to a particular day or a particular time. But this is still new enough that it's worth, for me, it's still worth commenting upon. Let me open by giving you some phone number and an email address and a website and those kinds of things. And I'm going to try today, if I can remember to do so, to periodically mention these same things again. I don't want to interrupt the flow of discussion, conversation, what we happen to be doing at the time. But on the other hand, I want everybody out there to know that your input and your response to this program is the reason that we're here at all. So in a sense, if there's a way to expedite or make easier your connection with us, with this program, and with me specifically, I want to make sure that I provide that. So I'm going to try to remember periodically to update phone numbers and email addresses and that kind of thing. If you would like to call and get on the air and talk about anything we have talked about in previous programs or what we're talking about right now, I know I'm aware that many of you download these programs or record these programs on iPods and listen to them later and all of this, and that's fine. But if you do want to interact with me as we go, then by all means, I encourage you to do so. Our phone number here is area code 304, and the number is 658-3333. That's 304-658-3333. The web that we'll be using for our program is prismwv.org, and I'm going to spell that. And the reason I'm going to do that is because some people have asked me, who have made references to the fact, I didn't know you were associated with the prisons, incarcerated adults and those kinds of things. We are talking about PRISM, P-R-I-S-M, the M as in me or in my, PRISM WV for West Virginia, .org, O-R-G. So PRISMWV.org. And I'll get back to that in a second. If you would like to email me directly, and I'd be happy to respond to emails, I haven't done this, given this address before, but you can reach me at W-A-O-B-R-I-E-N 906 at gmail.com. That's W-A-O-B-R-I-E-N 906 at gmail.com. The 906 is a number that I picked because it used to be years and years ago my dad's favorite number, and it's one that I won't forget, I guess this is what I'm saying. So it's WAOBRIAN 906 at gmail.com. I mentioned yesterday, and I want to mention again, that beginning in our next program, which will be Monday, the first of next week, I want to begin looking at and doing an analysis with you of Madison's Federalist Number 10, which is probably, I believe, the most important document in order to understand the nature of our union and the nature of the relationship between federal government and states on the one hand and federal government and individual citizens on the other. It's a very, very important document because it's the how it will work document written by James Madison, who basically wrote the system, the Constitution of the United States that we are dealing with. This weekend, we're going to upload the Federalist Number 10 on the WV.org website. Along with it, we're going to upload a document by James Madison written a year earlier called Vices of the American Political System. And in that Vices document, Madison is going to lay out what he sees are the major problems of the Confederation which need fixing. His rationale is the reason we need a constitution, the reason we need reform, the reason we are going to need a constitutional convention is to repair defects in the Articles of Confederation. And of course, we know, and if we didn't, then I want to make you aware of this now. The Constitutional Convention no sooner opens than the decision is made that the Articles of Confederation is beyond repair, and that what we really need to do is put it on the shelf and replace it with something more effective, which is defined in our history books as the Virginia Plan, and of course it becomes the Constitution of the United States, and that becomes the document around which debate will function throughout the summer of 1787 until the convention finally adjourns on the 17th of September, 1787. So in effect, the Constitutional Convention meets from late May. It's scheduled to start meeting on the 14th of May, but fact is there's not a quorum. Most of the states do not arrive until after the 14th of May, even though the 14th is the starting date. It's almost 2 weeks after that before all of the states that are sending delegates are represented. And so the convention is convened later in May. I believe it's the 28th of May, 2 weeks after the due date, the starting due date. I think that's very significant. I think it's very significant that so many states seem to think that there's time, that there's nothing urgent, that even though the opening session is due to be called, convened on May 14th, it's all right if we're not there until 3 or 4 days later, the next week or whatever. I think that's very, very significant. It's also significant that the Virginia delegation, headed by James Madison, of course, Richard Henry Lee and the others, the Virginia delegation is there at the appointed time. And so also are leaders of other delegations, delegation with Alexander Hamilton, the Pennsylvania delegation with James Wilson. The point that I would make is, for almost 2 weeks before the convention really begins to function, there is an opportunity for Madison and the other leaders of the Federalist group within Virginia to work the crowd, speak, to set up what is going to happen in this convention. So in a sense, when the convention does begin later in May, it begins with a bang. And Randolph, the governor of Virginia, Edmund Randolph, gives the welcoming address at the opening session of the Constitutional Convention in late May of 1787. And basically what he does is announce that the reason that everybody has come here is to revise the Articles of Confederation. But if we think about it, we all realize that those articles are such that they cannot really be revised, can be repaired or improved. And what we really need to do is scrap them and start all over again. And then he distributes copies of the Virginia Plan, which becomes the basis for the Constitution of the United States. So this is a very, very careful and prepared event. It's not just a group of people who happen to arrive in the same place and basically decide, all right, what do we do now? Where do we begin? There's a plan. There's an agenda. The Virginia delegation has it. Specifically, James Madison has it. Edmund Randolph, the governor, has it. And ultimately, the minute the chute opens, this script starts to play itself out. So it's very, very significant. And I think the vices of the vices of the American political system, written by Madison in 1786, and Federalist 10 document, which is written and published in 1788 in New York, are extremely significant documents. And so we'll begin those on Monday. I will mention it on Monday, but I want to mention it now. I will be putting copies of Federalist Number 10 and the vices on the PrismWV.org website, but I want to make it clear that you can find them elsewhere. If you go to Google on the internet and just type James Madison Vices of the American Political System, you will get the document that we'll be looking at. Likewise, if you type in Mass Federalist Number 10 on Google, you will get copies of that document as well. It's a readily available document. However, it's readily available, it's not so readily read. It's a very, very difficult document, and we'll work through it. It'll probably take a couple of days, but I think you'll find it worthwhile, and I think you'll find it extremely informative. I know that I have. I've been reading this document off and on over the years. I find it seems like it's one of those documents. It's kind of like the Bible in a way. It's one of those documents that every time you read it, you see something you didn't notice before. It's a rich document. There's a lot in it. There's a lot to talk about, a lot to discuss. There's a lot to debate. I think you'll find it very, very informative. So with that, let's let our program, and let's begin maybe by touching on a little bit of yesterday's program, where we ended yesterday, and then bringing that to an end, and then moving into something quite different today. If you remember yesterday, we were talking about education. We were talking about the nature or the kind of education in a republic. Basically, we were looking specifically at the program for the general diffusion of knowledge drafted by Thomas Jefferson in the 1770s and introduced into the state of Virginia. And we talked a lot about it. We basically talked about the nature of the education system that Jefferson proposed. We talked about the extent to which it appears that there were two systems of education operative in Jefferson's mind, that in his general diffusion of knowledge document, he is talking about the kind of education appropriate for the masses. And I think it is very, very important to recognize that Jefferson believed that the masses were not qualified or were not capable of a level of education, of academic rigor and depth and analysis that the leadership would be exposed to. So in a sense, Jefferson believed that there was one kind of education for the citizenry in a republic, and there's quite another kind of education for the leaders of that republic. And at the end of our time together yesterday, I read a quotation from Plato's Republic, specifically from his very famous of the cave, in which Plato explained a kind of education which is alien to what Jefferson was talking about in his general diffusion of knowledge. Because Plato believed that the skills, the abilities that constitute quality education are already within the individual, and that what is necessary for an educator, a teacher, is to draw out the truth that Plato says, the truth that already exists within the human soul. That's quite a bit different than the idea, than the educational approach of using content and assuming that the content itself, delivery of content, is education. And what we talked about at the end of our program yesterday is that it's not so much the delivery of content that constitutes education. Rather, it is what happens to the individual student as a result of engaging that content that constitutes the real education. In other words, educational progress, educational effectiveness is measured within the student based on the interaction of content. It's not measured by the content itself. So the reason I mentioned, we talked a lot yesterday about reasons we mentioned these things. I think it's pretty obvious where we are. But one additional thing that has occurred to me that I think it's obvious is that in our fetish today, in our overwhelming concern for educational progress and improvement, we constantly look at test scores, and we're constantly looking for increase in standardized test scores, which would indicate that our educational system is working better and better and better than it ever has before. And the point I would make is that most of that measurement is focused around student performance on standardized tests rather than the the growth and development that happens within the individual student. In other words, one of the things that the text experts, the numbers crunchers, tell us all the time in today's society is that while performance on standardized tests will improve with every administration, in other words, students are encouraged, take the college boards two or three times, you can increase your score, but not substantially. You're not going to go from a weak score to a strong score. Because the general impression is that the way the standardized tests are structured and organized, they present content that is generally expected, a student is generally expected to become familiar with over the years, over the entire span of his or her education. And so the chances are that the differences between one administration of the test and another administration of the test six months later probably isn't going to improve that much. However, I have to be honest, there are very expensive training sessions that many, many people in this field have begun and offer, and some of the best students who do the best on these standardized tests are able to afford these sessions, these training sessions that are run, many of them, by private educational corporations. And parents of students who are very highly motivated and going to our best schools are very, very concerned about the performance on these standardized tests. And oftentimes they will pay what to many of us are outlandish fees, outlandish costs for access to these training sessions. And they work. Very honestly, they do work because the materials used in those courses usually are previous exams, previous questions from earlier exams. And so there's no question that these training sessions do work. Fact of the matter is the average students are either not able to or interested in, they don't take as seriously these standardized tests, and the results show that, very honestly. So where we were yesterday at the end of our program was in thinking about and reflecting upon the definition of education that Plato has given us in his Allegory of the Cave, and contrasting that, comparing that with the general diffusion of knowledge approach to education that Jefferson gave us in the 1770s. And, of course, I think the differences between the two are dramatic, and I suggest that everybody appreciates that. And so, in a sense, my formula for reform, if I were to have one, would suggest that what we have to begin doing in order to really reform education, in order to really improve student performance, in order to really make education a viable opportunity for all students, is to begin to expose all students to the kinds of skill development and the kinds of skill demands that education offers the leaders. That, in other words, what we have to do is take seriously Jefferson's, Plato's statement that that truth already resides within the individual student. And what our challenge is to find ways to bring that truth out. In other words, ask the kinds of questions, demand the kind of rigor, and, you know, that cause students to really reflect on and ultimately be changed by their engagement with content. The result of that, you know, the basic element of that is the idea that it's one thing to read content, it's quite another to summarize it. It's even another to memorize the details from it. But there's something quite different than that. There's a step beyond that. It is the point at which you read critically enough that you begin to question. You begin to assess or to reflect upon the intent of the person that wrote the piece in the first place. You begin to question the audience. Who's the intended audience? What's the desired result? What does the author of this particular document want as a response from the reader or from the listener. What's the agenda here? Is the speaker merely presenting information, or is the speaker trying to persuade the audience to do something or believe something or reflect on something or question something? Is the, you know, what is the agenda? What is the intent? What are the implications? What would happen if everything the author of a particular piece wanted to happen happened? Who would benefit from it? Who would be punished, or who would suffer because of it? And then the next question is, does the author seem totally aware, completely aware, that everybody's not going to win? Some people are going to win, some people are going to lose, if everything that this particular piece wants to happen, happen. The point I'm trying to make is, by asking those kinds of questions, students do not just read pieces of history, they engage it. They engage content. They reflect on it. They understand it. They begin to reflect on possible alternatives to it. And the result is that they grow. Their understanding of the world around them, their understanding of the issues in the day-to-day life that they live, totally change and totally expand. That's what we call the nature of an educated person. Plato believed that it was the guardians, the philosopher kings in his ideal republic that would benefit from and had to be exposed to that kind of education. In this country, I believe that what makes America indeed exceptional is that we have taken on the challenge of giving every citizen an opportunity to be educated that way, knowing full well that every citizen is not equally capable of handling it. We know that. But if that's the route to success, if that's what society demands of its leaders, of those people who are going to rise to the top in our society in terms of becoming corporate executives and business leaders, and college professors and researchers and all of these, if the top positions and top jobs in our society require this kind of an education, then it seems to me we as a society have an obligation to give every one of our children an opportunity to master it. Sometimes, in a way, I'm being facetious when I say this. Sometimes I say this to students in classes I teach, but I really believe it. I believe that there's a way to do this. As I tell students, in many, many ways, quality education is kind of a game. There are rules of that game. There's a way to play it. I believe that if everybody knows how to play it, many people who have experienced nothing but failure in our education system can become successful. I think we're seeing that in some of the things that are happening in our society today. One of the major educational reform initiatives that we are dealing with in America right now is the so-called Khan Academy, K-A-H-N, which is based in California. And Sal Khan has created what effectively shows promise of becoming an educational revolution in America. What he's basically doing is using technology, using the internet, using videos, YouTube videos, to present the content and giving students, all students, access to content that they can go take home. They can look at it over and over again. In other words, students don't just sit there and witness one lecture. They have the lecture as their own property, whether it's on a YouTube that they get on the internet or a disc or a CD or whatever. They take the presentation of content home and they master it. If they don't understand it the first time, they listen to it again. They listen to it a third time. They contact friends, classmates, and say, can we meet and listen to this together and see if we can figure it out? So by the time the student comes to class and reassembles with all the other students in that class, hopefully he or she has been able to master or at least understand better than they ever understood before what the particular lesson is about. The whole nature, the whole definition of the role of teacher changes from teacher ceasing to be the sage on stage that delivers a lecture. The teacher becomes a coach. The teacher becomes a real teacher. The teacher is able to focus time, to devote time to the students who are still having trouble. But the students who have totally mastered the concept are free to go on to a different concept, which is on a different video. And what that does is allow students to master the material at their own pace. They aren't held back by the teacher's need to focus on the slower students. But on the other hand, the slower students finally are beginning to get the attention from the teacher that they need to move on. So in a sense, this Khan Academy approach to education is effectively becoming a revolution in our nation today. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has put millions of dollars into this initiative. So novel has it become. This is the kind of education that the few have gotten over the decades in our best American schools. Now, through the availability of technology, we're able to offer it to the many. Everybody won't be able to handle it. Everybody won't be able to master as the content becomes more and more rigorous and more involved and takes one to a higher level. But what we have here is the potential that students are going to be able to go to the level that satisfies their potential. And the fact of the matter is, more and more people are going to find out about what the excitement of learning is all about. I think that's incredible. Once people realize that learning is exciting, it's not boring, it's exciting. Not only that, but once they begin to realize that they can learn and that they can understand things that the education system up to this point has told them they can't, then their potential becomes greater, their opportunities becomes greater, their career aspirations become a little bit more ambitious, and ultimately we as a nation, we as a society, begin to approach the idea of everybody in this society really having an equal opportunity to be successful. That is what the American dream is all about. That is what the founders, in the documents they wrote and the questions they asked, that is the potential of popular government and the nature of a democratic republic. That is the essence of American exceptionalism. Damn it, that is what we need to start doing in our schools. And I'm hoping against hope that right here on the Head On Radio Network, which has been kind enough and brave enough to broadcast programming from this center on the study for the U.S. Constitution, we are going to begin that process. We are going to be making the documents, the hardcore content, available to those who choose to listen and to engage. We will discuss, we will hopefully, we will begin to convince people that they can learn, they can understand, and they can move beyond the limits that society has tried to place upon them. Remember, the founders came from a society which was highly structured. They did not believe. They knew that committing to the idea of a republic, committing to the idea of the principles of the Declaration, that all men are created equal and basically provided by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. This was pretty risky, because a lot of people took this seriously, and a lot of people believed that that's what the goals of this society are about. I would suggest to you, those are the goals that make America an exceptional society. And if we really want to have the kind of impact in the world, we don't need to keep putting trillions of dollars into military equipment and into the military. We need to begin to educate our people so that the world can see what we're producing and how we're producing it. And once we do that, the world will reform itself. I believe that. I believe that John Winthrop was absolutely correct. We can be a city upon a hill. The whole world will look at us, and the whole world will appreciate where we've come from, what we've been able to do, and the quality of life that we've been able to make available to all of our students. That is, it seems to me, what American exceptionalism potentially is about. That is what it ought to be about, and that's what we've got to be about making happen. So, you know, I really think that this is significant. But as I pointed out yesterday, we as a nation have not really been willing to take the gamble. We've not really been willing to take the risk of giving everybody access to the kind of education that we're talking about here. It's frightening. It's scary. If you think about a society that has come from a world which believes firmly that society is structured, that there are those at the bottom, those in the middle, and those at the top, that people are born and destined to fulfill certain roles and certain functions in society, and to mix it all up, to create chaos by saying everybody starts even, it's like a race, and everybody ought to have an opportunity to be at the starting line when the gun goes off. That's scary, that's frightening. Because now you're basically saying to yourself, the people that we expect to win may not win. There may be people coming from the back of the pack that we never knew had these kinds of skills, or this kind of drive, or this kind of ambition, or these talents. There could be people coming and rising to the top that nobody in society expected to happen. Some people find that frightening. Some people find it frightening that everybody believes that they have the same rights as everybody else ought to have. That's not the history of the world. The history of the world doesn't reinforce that kind of a society. So many people are afraid of it. So the question is, how do you fulfill some of the ideals of republicanism and what it has to form? How do you do that and at the same time protect yourself? Built in the kind of guarantees and the kind of protections and the kind of obstacles that are going to guarantee that the right people prevail and the wrong people don't. How do you do that? And that's what we've been dealing with. And one of the things that has bothered me is that as a society, we have never been able to take that gamble. We have always insisted that it's important to teach people what to believe and what to think, not, it's very dangerous to teach people how to think. Because when you teach people how to think, you lose the right to control what they think. And so that risk, as a society, we've not been able to take. Can I give you an example of that? And then we'll basically move on to something else. Not too long after the new government went into effect, I might have mentioned this in a previous program, and if I did, I don't mean to repeat myself, but I have a quotation here that I think is very significant. As we talked about, the new government, after the Constitution is ratified, goes into effect in March of 1789. Washington is inaugurated as the first president, etc. And we know we have 8 years of George Washington, and then we have 4 years of John Adams, and then we have 8 years of Thomas Jefferson, and then we have 8 years of James Madison, and then we have, following James Madison, is James Monroe. So the initial years of the nation are focused primarily on leaders, presidents from the state of Virginia. We won't go there, enough people have. But not too long at the end of the War of 1812, in 1816, a bill is introduced in the Senate of the United States to tax, to put a tariff, a tax, on books coming into the United States from foreign countries. And, of course, as we know, you can do a lot of things politically with the power to tax. If you tax enough, if you tax heavily enough, you make it likely that consumers will not buy because the tax is added on to the price of the product. And if you tax heavily, then what you do is raise the price of the product so high that people won't buy it. If that happens to be your objective, in other words, if you are intentionally taxing at a high rate in order to drive the price of the product up so people won't buy it, then your goals are not economic, they are political. Because if your goals are political, if your goals were economic, you would be looking for the revenue to be derived from the increase in taxes. But if you make the taxes high knowing full well that people won't buy the product, then your objective ceases to be economic and becomes political. You are making a judgment that people will be better off if they don't buy that product. So if we begin to assess a tariff or a tax on books coming into the United States, what we are effectively doing is inflating the price of those books, knowing full well that the general population within the United States will probably not buy them and therefore not read them. So in a sense, what you are doing is putting a political shell around the nation. You are shielding citizens from foreign ideas, from foreign content, from foreign literature, from foreign political ideas, etc. Anyway, In 1816, Congress enacts an import tax on foreign books. Gordon Wood, in his Empire of Liberty, talks about this and makes the point that Jefferson, who of course has been president of the United States by this time, Jefferson protests the bill, as does Harvard and Yale and many of the nation's elite institutions, the American Philosophical Society, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Many of these highly academic institutions in America oppose this kind of a thing because they see it as what they were. It's anti-learning, it's anti-intellectual, it's anti-academic, it's anti-American. It's totally contrary to the whole idea of the nature of the free exchange of ideas. If you believe that the value of America is the idea of the free marketplace and competition and exchange of ideas with the ideas that outcome that the best ideas will kind of rise to the top and prevail. If you believe in that model or that image, then a tax on foreign books has to be something that you will oppose. Okay, here's my point. The chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, in a speech, defended the bill's intent to protect the nation's young from foreign dangerous ideas. And this is a quote from what he said on the floor of the United States Senate. Our government is peculiar to ourselves, and our books of instruction should be adapted to the nature of the government and the genius of the people. In other words, our people living in a republic need to be shielded from ideas that are not consistent with but contradict the ideas of republican government. We as a government have a responsibility to protect our people from dangerous ideas. I would suggest to you that that smacks of this whole idea of what our approach to education ought to be. We are afraid to allow our people to see and read and discuss ideas that we're not able to screen first. And the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee goes on. In the best of foreign books, we are liable to meet with criticism and comparisons not very flattering to the American people. In American editions of these, the offensive and illiberal parts are expunged or explained, and the work is adapted to the exigencies and tastes of the American reader. In other words, what we try to do is we intercept these books and we put out American versions of the same book. And in those, we expunge illiberal parts, or we try to explain them in such a way that we are protecting the purity of the American reader. I'm thinking of a conversation we had at the end of last week on our program with Betsy, the teacher from Texas, and she talked about the fact that in her library in Texas, the school library, there are no books, even though half of her student body is Hispanic. And while there are many books in the library that are in Spanish, none of them are written in Spain. They're all written in the United States. They're all carefully screened and monitored and all the rest of it. So tell me that we are not still following the dictates of our approach to education as laid out by Jefferson in the late 18th century and our political leaders in the early 19th century. This speech goes on. But withdraw the protection. Our channels of instruction will be foreign. In other words, if we allow these books in, we will be giving foreign ideas direct access to our young people. Our youth will imbibe sentiment, form attachments, and acquire habits adverse to our prosperity, unfriendly to our government, and dangerous to our liberties. From the very beginning of this nation, we are in the business of putting up barriers, roadblocks, obstacles, in order to shield our young people from ideas that we don't approve of. In loco parentis, in place of parents, government is assuming the role almost from the get-go of parents by protecting our youngsters from negative or foreign ideas that haven't been screened or properly altered. I think this is very significant, and it seems to me, smacks of something that one of our founders, one of our more prominent founders, Benjamin Rush, wrote during the Confederation period in 1786, which I've made reference to more than once before, called The Mode of Education Proper in a Republic, Thoughts Upon the Mode of Education Proper in a Republic. And in it, Rush talks about the fact that what our schools have to be about is the production of Republican machines. That's his term. He says, our students must be taught that there can't, this is a quote, that there can be no durable liberty except in a republic, and that without this, there can be no virtue. Without virtue, there can be no liberty, and liberty is the object in life of all republican governments. So, in a sense, the only way that you can protect liberty, which is the object and the life of republican governments, is to do everything you can to create virtue. And the way you create virtue is to basically monitor and script the ideas that we present to students under the heading of educational opportunity. So when Rush talks about creating little Republican machines, he's not giving us an exercise in idle banter. He's saying something that is very, very significant. Here's something else that Benjamin Rush talks about in this document. It kind of reinforces the approach to education that Jefferson has given us a decade before. And Rush says, our schools of learning, by producing one general uniform system of education, will render the mass of the people more homogeneous and thereby fit them more easily for uniform and peaceable government. That's a sentence that's worth repeating. our schools of learning by producing one general uniform system of education will render the mass of the people more homogeneous and thereby fit them more easily for uniform and peaceable government. The purpose of universal education in a republic is the security and safety of the society, not the academic growth, the intellectual growth of the individual student. In effect, you might say, I won't go this far, but you can say it, that our schools from the very beginning were never about developing the capabilities of students. They were always about fitting students into the priorities of the society at large, making the republic happen, and educating students in such a way that they would become functioning, virtuous citizens in the republic that we have created. And, of course, we talked earlier last week about the nature of that republic and how it differed from some of the things that people wanted when they talked about republican government. And if you read Benjamin Rush, whereas Jefferson believed that the first 3 years of universal education ought to focus primarily on history, for reasons that we talked about yesterday, Rush believes that the curriculum in the general education that the masses receive for education proper in a republic ought to be based principally on religion. If you read Rush's document, he is not trying to create Christians. He's not proselytizing for religious reasons. His purpose is to produce citizens who are governable, who become easy, willing citizens and are easily governed. He says, I would rather have the religion of Muhammad or Confucius inculcated upon our students than allow them to grow up devoid of some system of religious principles. And then he goes on to say, as long as the religion has a heaven as reward for good behavior and a hell for the reward for bad behavior, as long as people, as young people know that they're rewarded for doing what's right and penalized for doing what's wrong, then any religion will work. But then, Rush says, of all the religions available, I believe, as he says, that Christianity, the religion of Jesus Christ, is the religion which will best produce citizens, proper citizens in a republic. And I want to read the paragraph from Rush's document that makes that point. He says, it is foreign to my purpose to hint at the arguments which establish the truth of the Christian revelation. When he says it's foreign to my purpose about this, what he's basically saying is, my job is not to create Christians. That's not what I'm doing. I'm not converting anybody. My only business, he says, is to declare that all its doctrines, Christianity's, and precepts are calculated to promote the happiness of society and the safety and well-being of civil government. The reason he wants Christianity in the schools, the reason he wants the Bible as a textbook that people learn to read from, is because Christianity, more than any other religion, he says, is based on doctrines and precepts that are calculated to promote the happiness of society and the safety and the well-being of civil government. And he goes on, a Christian cannot fail of being a Republican, for every precept of the gospel inculcates those degrees of humility, self-denial, and brotherly kindness which are directly opposed to the pride of monarchy and the pageantry of a court. In other words, what makes the United States, our republic, different is that we are setting up an alternative to monarchy, an alternative to absolute government, an alternative to the pageantry of the courts of Europe. And in order to do that, Christianity is perfect because Christianity preaches the kind of humility, self-denial, and brotherly kindness which are opposed to the kind of political life that seems to function in a monarchy or around a court. And he goes on, I'm quoting again, "A Christian cannot fail of being useful to the Republic, for his religion teacheth him that no man liveth to himself." In other words, a Christian cannot help of being a good citizen in a republic because Christianity teaches that man is not an island, that man lives in a community, and therefore he has responsibilities to other people around him. It's not just what's good for him. A Christian learns the old idea, the golden rule. A Christian must respect the rights of other people. And Rush says, "And lastly, a Christian cannot fail of being wholly inoffensive, for his religion teacheth him in all things to do to others as he would wish in light circumstances they should do to him." The golden rule. Matthew's, the Beatitudes. In other words, the reason that Rush wants Christianity as the heart of curriculum in our schools for Republican youngsters in a republic is because Christianity puts value, puts a premium on the very qualities that we are looking for in our citizens. Docility, humility, self-denial, brotherly kindness, respect for others, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, charity toward your fellow man, all the kind of things that make for the nature of a republic, the ingredients of what we call virtue, are the priorities of the Christian religion. Therefore, to Rush, Christianity becomes the means toward the political ends that he wants to create through his mode of education proper in a republic. It's kind of putting wheels under Jefferson's approach to education. It's an elaboration, if you will, of the nature of republic and the kinds of citizens that these people believe we must have in order for a republic to work. But it's very obvious, and I ask students this all the time in class, if you read Jefferson and if you read Benjamin Rush, is there anything in these documents that even hints that the students being exposed to this definition of education are being groomed to be leaders? I would suggest to you this is an approach to education that is designed to produce followers, not leaders. The leaders are being educated elsewhere in a different way. They are being educated around the model that, for lack of a better example of it, we pick up from Plato in his Republic as the education that Plato believes must be delivered to those who will be philosopher kings, who will be the leaders of Plato's ideal republic. Wow. When you think about all of this together, what a fantastic, fascinating situation we have. It seems to me that not only have we identified some of the problems in our education system, we have also very intentionally, I might add, we have also scoped out, I believe, ways that we can begin to address the problem and really reform education in this republic. And I firmly believe, I have devoted my professional life to believing that when we begin to educate our people differently, when we begin to really deliver on our promise of equal opportunity to everybody in our schools, through our school system, we will indeed begin, we will be moving toward the ideals which many people define as American exceptionalism. I believe it. I have long believed it. I continue to believe it. And the more I read about the founders, the more I am convinced that this is really what the potential of the republic that they created is all about. Many, many people today, and I'm kind of winding up this first hour here so that we can take a break and get into something totally different in our second hour. But what we hear all the time are those people that go to the founders and look for evidence in the founders that what they really wanted was a system of free market competitive capitalism. We hear it all the time. They go to Locke, they go to Jefferson, they go to the others. They go to Madison because, as we'll see Monday when we look at Federalist Number 10, they go to Madison because Madison puts a premium on individual liberty. And they and modern conservatives make the connection in their minds and say, if Madison was putting a premium on freedom, on individual freedom, then ultimately he was downgrading and pushing to the back burner, putting on the back burner the whole idea of equality that Jefferson talks about in the Declaration. What we're talking about here is freedom, the freedom to excel, the freedom to rise to the top. There's no question that Madison was talking about that. There's no question that Jefferson was talking about that. However, they did not do it to the exclusion of the people that did not rise to the top. Every one of them talked about the fact that we live in a commonwealth. We live in a republic. We live in a society where everybody can't be a chief. An awful lot of us, an awful lot of us end up to be Indians. And the fact of the matter is, freedom is not something to only be enjoyed by the chiefs at the expense of the Indians. Freedom is something that leads to success. But part of living in a commonwealth, part of living in a republic, part of following the dictates of Jefferson and Madison and the rest of them is recognizing that we have responsibilities to our neighbors, to our fellow man. And in our second hour today, we will be looking more carefully at that because we will be looking at the writings of one John Locke, who's probably the classic epitome of an Enlightenment thinker, an Enlightened political theorist. But more important than that, John Locke seems to be the place where conservatives go all the time to justify the origins of the idea that Jefferson put in the Declaration, that all men are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. And among these are the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Liberty, freedom, individual freedom to acquire property and to expect government to protect your property. That's what conservatives claim Locke was all about when he talked about man's entry, exit from the state of nature into the state of society, the social contract. Basically, conservatives emphasize the sanctity of private property and the absolute priority of individual freedom over everything else. I would suggest to you that in the process of doing that, they have not misinterpreted Locke. They have excluded elements from John Locke that suggest something quite different, that we have a commonwealth, we have a community. We have other people in it, all of whom have the right to expect that they, too, are free to pursue and acquire property and have it protected. That is not possible if a few people control everything, which is what we seem to be facing in today's society. So with that, let's break for 4 or 5 minutes and take a break, and we'll be right back for our second hour. This is Bill O'Brien. Please stay with us. We have another hour to go.
now return to the Virtual Center for the Study of the U.S. Constitution. Here is your host, Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Thank you, Bob, and thank you for listening today, for being with us today. Let me again, I said I was going to do this, and I didn't. I got carried away with the material, and I've done that all my life. I don't think it's a negative, very honestly, but it sometimes means that I don't do the things that I plan to do at the front end. And one of them, as I mentioned, was that I was regularly going to be giving you phone numbers and email addresses and websites and those kinds of things. So let me do that now. If you would like to make a comment or call or engage in conversation or offer a point of view or a suggestion or a question or a criticism, I mean, a disagreement or whatever, by all means, feel free to do that. I would love to hear from you. We've had a couple of calls over the course of our time together so far, but I'm anticipating, hopefully, as we go down the line, that there'll be much more of, you know, there'll be much more dialogue and much less monologue. But the number that you can call right now is area code 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333. That'll get you into the studio, and we'll get you right on the air. If you would like to email me personally, of course, right now I can't respond to your email because I'm doing this. But if you send me an email at WAOBRIEN, O-B-R-I-E-N, all one word, WAOBRIEN, 906 at gmail.com. That's WAOBRIEN, 906 at gmail.com. I'd be more than happy to hear from you. I'd be more than happy to, you know, this evening or in the morning, I will respond to your email. I always do. I encourage all of my students to stay in touch with me through email. I'm very, very interested in their reaction to what I'm doing, because I believe, I guess I really do try to live up to what I'm saying here. I do believe that education has nothing to do with what I say. Education has to do with what's happening at the other end, based on some of the things that I've said and some of the documents that we look at and various other things. So as much as possible, I'm trying to basically operate our program, our time together, on the same model that we talked about for education. And again, let me mention that on Monday, we'll be focusing on two documents by James Madison, his Vices of the American Political System, written in 1786, and his Federalist No. 10 document, written in 1788. Those documents will be on the PRISM WV website, which is PRISM. That's M in my, or is in me. Not prison, as in incarcerate behind bars, but PRISM. PRISMWV.org. That's PRISMWV.org. I was thinking, in when I mentioned the word prism, of the very famous story of Pollyanna that maybe many of you are familiar with. And there's a place in there where Pollyanna is exposed to a prism, and the light is coming in the window and is reflecting, and she sees this panoply of colors, different colors because of the prism, the fact that the prism is reflecting light in all different directions. And so what she is doing is she's seeing the world in a number of different colors and a number of different ways. That's why I named the grant program PRISM, because I wanted people to be able to look. I wanted West Virginia students to be able to look at their own Appalachian West Virginia heritage and then look at the nation as a whole as it developed around them, and begin to understand it through the prism of their own experiences. And that was really what my intent was when I wrote the PRISM grant. I had promised that we were going to be doing something different, and I kind of gave a hint as to what it was. I think where we're heading is to John Locke here, mainly because conservatives are so focused on looking at the writings specifically of John Locke. And I'm reading from a text that I wrote. I don't like to do that, but it says pretty much what I want to say, so I'm going to do it. Today's conservatives emphasize personal liberty, the sanctity of private property, and the free exercise of natural rights in Locke's State of Nature in order to rationalize support for a government that they insist must have severe limits and remain always accountable to its citizens. In other words, conservatives believe that the whole reason for government is to protect rights, nothing more. And again, that's true. It's how you define that we'll get into. They usually agree with something out of Cato's letters that was written in the colonial period, and I quoted this elsewhere, which said basically, the remedy of creating government in the first place proved worse than the disease. Conservatives believe that requiring government at all is unfortunate. As Madison said in Federalist Number 51, if men were angels, we wouldn't need government at all. So they would prefer that men were angels, but they readily admit that they're not. Therefore, we have to have government, we have to have rules, we have to have somebody to enforce the rules, et cetera, et cetera. That's why we need government. So basically, to conservatives, government is a necessary evil, not a positive, not anything good for citizens, but a necessary evil to restrain the freedom of citizens. Liberals, ironically, also can go to Locke, but many of them don't because they don't know what we're going to cover. They don't really know what's in Locke because conservatives have such a bully pulpit in order to tell us what Locke says about individual liberty, private property, and the limitations on the powers of government that we find it unnecessary to go to Locke. Because they're telling us what's in there. But, oh, that's not only what's in there. There's a lot more in Locke than they're telling us. Liberals can go to the same document, the Second Treatise on Civil Government, written by John Locke in 1689, and they can focus on the reasons Locke gives us, for why man left the state of nature in the first place. Why the social contract is proof that human rights and freedom demand a government that is strong and a government that works to create, that requires citizens who are virtuous and who are willing to put the best interests of community ahead of their own self-interest. The founders believed that republic, going all the way back to the Roman Republic, the founders believed that a republic required a virtuous citizenry. Benjamin Rush and Jefferson both are laying out an educational system, a formula that they believe will ensure us the kind of virtuous citizenry that would be necessary for a republic to work. However, the nature of the citizenry they're talking about is one which is docile and obedient and non-aggressive and non-competitive and compliant and all the rest of it. So, in a sense, they had a very particular definition of virtue in mind. I believe, and I think all of us would agree, that when we talk about virtue, we're talking about a little bit more than is evident in Jefferson's plan for education or in Benjamin Rush's presentation either. Let me turn to John Locke, and let me tell you that if you read John Locke's Second Treatise on Civil Government, it's very long and it's very heavy. It's philosophy. It's political philosophy. And what I'm looking at right now, today, what I'm asking you to think about are excerpts from Chapter 23 of Locke's treatise. Second Treatise on Civil Government. So this is one part of the 23rd chapter of a whole book that John Locke wrote on the nature of government, the origin of man, and the origins of government, the nature of man, etc. But this is the part that focuses on the issues that we're focusing on, namely the nature of the republic. Locke is talking about the state of nature. What it was like in the state of nature. And if you remember yesterday, we're talking about Locke and Hobbes and comparing the two. And I don't want to go back over that again. But Locke believed that the state of nature was not a real place, but was an imaginary place that man would live in before man left it to enter into an organized, structured society. In other words, if one could imagine a time, a place, where man was totally free to do whatever he wanted to do, what would it be like? And you remember yesterday I made the point that the only time you can really get into this, if you just sit in your own little room with the door closed and a beer and nothing else, and you think about it. So maybe because it's only 5 in the evening, and of course the old song, it's 5 o'clock somewhere, so maybe some of you are popping a beer right now, I don't know. But anyway, let's listen to Locke specifically, and then let's basically deal with what the man says. In talking about the state of nature, Locke says, "But though this be a state of liberty, yet it is not a state of license." Let's stop there for a second. Though the state of nature be a state of liberty, it is not a state of license. While people are free, their freedom does not go to the point that they have the right to do anything they want. So while they have freedom, it is kind of limited. And now he's going to go on and explain those limitations. Though man in that state have an uncontrollable liberty to dispose of his person or possessions, yet he has not liberty to destroy himself or so much as any creature in his possession, but where some nobler use than its bare preservation calls for it. Man is free, but he is not free. He does not have the right to dispose of his own person. In other words, suicide is not a right. And of course, what Locke is going to say later on is because we get our life from God, therefore God is the only way, that's the only place, the only person that can take life away. We do not have the right to take our own life because it's not our property. Locke says that while you are free in the state of nature, you do not have the right to dispose of your own person or possessions. You do not have the liberty to destroy yourself or to destroy any other creature in within your power, within your purview, unless there is a nobler use to be made of it than bare preservation. In other words, he is opening the door here to the idea of capital punishment. It may be necessary to take a life, but the only circumstances under which taking any life is acceptable is when a nobler use is to be gained, a nobler purpose is to be gained by taking the life than by preserving it. So he is justifying here, under very, very limited circumstances, the idea of capital punishment. And he goes on. The state of nature has a law of nature to govern it, which obliges everyone, and reason, which is that law, teaches all mankind who will but consult it, that being all equal and independent, no one ought to harm another in his life, health, liberty, or possessions. So again, man in the state of nature is free. He has liberty, but that liberty is not license. It doesn't give you the right to take your own life, and it doesn't give you the right to take any other life either unless the purpose to be gained is more noble the state of nature has a law to govern it. And that state of that law is reason. He says it very specifically. Man's reason, man's common sense, man's ability to think and to think logically is the law in the state of nature. It obliges everyone. And it teaches everyone who will consult it, Locke says, that since everybody in the state of nature is free and equal, no one ought to harm another in his life, health, liberty, or possessions. For man being all the workmanship of one omnipotent and infinitely wise maker, in other words, we are all children of God, all the servants of one sovereign master, sent into the world by his order and about his business. The reason we are here is because we have given life, we have been given life by the divine maker. Only the divine maker gives us, has the right to take that life or to give us the right to take another life unless the circumstances warrant it. And I think that's very, very significant. They, meaning these lives, human lives, they are his property, whose workmanship they are made to last during his, not one another's pleasure. In other words, life is granted by God. It is not ours to take. It is God's to take. And being furnished with like faculties, the ability of all of us to think, to reason, to understand, to evaluate, to assess, to know, to appreciate, to understand. I'm thinking of all the words off the top that I can think of because I'm doing it in the context of the approach to education that we've been considering for the last day and a half. It's very obvious that our education system does not really respect in everybody those particular skills, those particular assets of being John Locke says that these lives are God's property, and those lives are made to last during his pleasure, not ours, not anybody else's. And being furnished with like faculties, the fact that we can all think, we can all reason, that means we are all vulnerable and susceptible to the law of nature. We all know what it is because it's reason, and we all can reason. We all have like faculties, sharing all in one community of nature, he says. There cannot be supposed any such subordination among us that may authorize us to destroy one another, as if we were made for one another's uses, as the inferior ranks of creatures are for ours. In other words, because God gave man a mind, that means we can all think. That means we can all reason. That means we can all understand the law of nature. That means we can all appreciate the importance of the law of nature. That means because we are limited in our freedom by that law, there are certain things we know we can do and certain things that we know we can't do. And one of the things we know is that we're not only the ones that have that freedom, but everybody else around us has the same freedoms. Therefore, they can reason. And just as they have to respect our life, our possessions, our freedom, so also we have a responsibility to respect theirs. Everyone, as he is bound to preserve himself, Locke says, and not to quit his station willfully, so by the like reason, when his own preservation comes not in competition, ought he, as much as he can, to preserve the rest of mankind, and not unless it be to do justice on an offender, take away or impair the life, or what tends to be the preservation of the life, the liberty, health, limb, or goods of another. That is a key sentence in Locke. When your own preservation is not in jeopardy, or as Locke says, when your own preservation comes not in competition, when it's not about preserving your own life, protecting yourself, then every one of us, as much as he can, ought to preserve the rest of mankind. And not unless it be to do justice to an offender, take away or impair the life or what tends to be the preservation of the life, property, health, limb, or goods of another. In other words, what Locke is emphasizing here is the law of nature's responsibility for all of us to look out for each other. Once we've got what we need, then we have a responsibility to be concerned about the life, freedom, limbs, health, and possessions of those around us. In other words, Locke is emphasizing the community responsibilities that are part of the law of nature. Those are the responsibilities. I'm out of the document here. This is me talking. Those are the responsibilities that I believe are as much a part of Locke as is his emphasis on individual freedom and the responsibility of government that man creates to protect his life, his liberty, and his property. Man's responsibilities to each other, to what he calls the Commonwealth. Everybody who lives in the Commonwealth was born a child of God. Everyone was given the same faculties. Everyone was given the same liberties. In that context, we are all equal. I would suggest to you, when political conservatives focus on Jefferson's Declaration of Independence, they are so inclined to focus on the inalienable rights to life, liberty, and property and the responsibilities of government to protect them, but they are equally as inclined, if not more so, to ignore Jefferson's first right, which is the right to be equal and the right to be considered equal to everybody else. Jefferson says that these truths are self-evident, that we are endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights. And among these are the fact that we were created as equals. We have a right to equality, and that is an important part of John Locke, as it is, as is his emphasis on individual freedom and private property. And then Locke goes on and says, and that all men may be restrained from invading others' rights and from doing hurt to one another, and the law of nature be observed, which willeth the peace and preservation of all mankind. And what Locke is going into here, what he's talking about, is the social contract. What would, and this is me, I'm interpreting Locke rather than reading all of this. What would cause man to leave the state of nature? If he's free, if reason, the law of nature, protects his property and his life and his possessions, then what circumstances would cause man to voluntarily consent to create government and give it power to protect his rights? Obviously, the answer to that is one of inconvenience. In the state of nature, the only people, the only way that the law of nature can be enforced is by everybody in it. And Locke lays out the responsibilities of people to enforce the law of nature. If you violate the law of nature, you have every expectation that you will be punished for that because you broke the law. Well, obviously, the only people that can enforce the law in the state of nature are the people who are in it. And that becomes very inconvenient. And man's reason, his common sense, would suggest that there probably is a better way. So man decides, man reasons, that it would be more convenient to create a government and give it the power to protect these rights so we didn't have to bother. And so with government protecting our rights, we could concentrate more on our freedom and our happiness and all the rest of it. And so therefore, man reasons, voluntarily consents to the social contract. And the social contract is the agreement that all men reach to voluntarily leave the state of nature and to move into an organized society that is governed by a government, but a government whose powers are extremely limited to the protection of man's rights, liberty, and property, his life, liberty, and property, as Jefferson says in the Declaration. So to Locke, to this Enlightenment thinker, that is the origin of government. Those are the limitations on it. The reality is that Locke believes that human nature is not all that bad. We talked about Hobbes yesterday and how Hobbes believed you had to have an absolute government, you had to have an absolutely all-powerful sovereign because human nature was so bad. Locke did not believe that. Locke believed that man's nature was good, that because man had reason and because everybody had it, that man would logically conclude, would reason, would understand that if I want my rights protected, I got to be willing to respect the rights and the freedoms of other people as well. And Locke believed that that reason, that common sense, would preserve the safety and security and happiness of people in the state of nature. But the fact that man voluntarily consented to leave the state of nature and enter into a society and create government over that society suggests that the protection of the enforcement of the laws of nature, the law of nature, by individuals was not efficient or the way to go. And that creating a government and giving it the power to do that is much more logical and is much more efficient and potentially would be effective. The point that I want to make in our program, in our time together today, is the fact that if you read this carefully, this is chapter 23, an excerpt from chapter 23 of John Locke's essay on civil government. It is very, very realistic. It is important to note that Locke, not for a minute, does John Locke deny the existence of a commonwealth. Not for a minute does Locke suggest that we don't have responsibilities to each other. Not for a minute does Locke suggest that when people leave the state of nature and enter society, they do so with the idea that they are creating a commonwealth. That within that commonwealth, everybody should be treated equally. Everybody should have equality of opportunity. Everybody should have access to the golden ring, as it were. And that government's responsibilities must be to everybody because the law of nature applied to everybody. This is one of the most important things about Locke that is, you know, that Locke does not say, but conservatives do all the time, if you think about this. If you think about Locke as we've just looked at him, you can draw a couple of possible conclusions from Locke, especially if you were inclined to ignore the community obligations that are inherent in Locke from the very beginning. One is that if man chooses to leave the state of nature in order to protect his property, in order to protect his life, his liberty and his property. And Locke, in another place in this essay, makes the point that in the use of the term property, he includes life and liberty as well. In other words, he assumes all of these can be looked upon as property. The point I would make is, if man leaves the state of nature, if man creates to create government in order so that his property will be protected, then the implications are that government's number one obligation is to the people with property. The implication further is that those who live in society and do not own property have no rights. Think about that. Because many people believe that. They won't say it, but they believe it. They believe that the ownership, the possession of property, gives them more rights than the people who don't have any property or have very little of it. They believe that the only right of freedom that people have is the right to acquire property and nothing else. In other words, this is the conservative property focused approach to John Locke that excludes the idea of community. This is the way that you can push community into the background and pretend that Locke never even mentioned it. Because you can conclude, very logically you can argue, that if man left the state of nature in order to ensure the protection of property, then that means that in society the only people that would have rights at all would be the people with property. The only people that would have the right to limit government are those who own property. And therefore, those without property would not have any rights at all. One could logically conclude that. So I think that that is extremely, extremely significant. Let me suggest a couple of other things. Just taking that particular logic one step further, one could also conclude that government's priority, government's principal duty in responding to the consent of the governed is to respond only to the consent of those who have property that might be threatened. In other words, those with property, their consent carries more weight than the consent of those without property. That's kind of a continuation of the first point. And the third conclusion, a third conclusion that we could reach from Locke, is that except for foreign aggression, except for the invasion of others and threats to your life, liberty, and property that might come from foreign invasion, it's pretty obvious that if you exclude foreign invasion, the only threats to property would come, the most likely threat to property would come from those without property. In other words, one could conclude that the greatest threat to property comes from those who don't have it, the poor. Therefore, the next piece of this logic would suggest that government's number one obligation is to protect the propertied from those who don't have it. This is the definition of commonwealth that conservatives choose to accept. The only freedom that those without property have is the freedom to try to acquire property and know that if they do acquire any, it will be protected and secured by government. But up until they become property owners, they don't have any rights. That seems to be a logical conclusion if you interpret John Locke's treatise this way. And a final point, which I think is critical to the whole thing. if you interpret Locke this way, then the only way that you have a right to expect the majority, and we know that the majority is always the poor, the property are always the few. If you interpret Locke this way, then what you can conclude is that the only reason that those without property would consent to be governed is if they believed that they had an equal opportunity to acquire property. If they ever believed for a minute that they didn't have that right, then why would they subscribe to the to the laws governing the community? Why would they be obedient to government? What's in it for them? In other words, if they were condemned forever to be poor and not to have a shot at success, why should they obey the rules? Why should they go along? Why should they become docile and practice self-denial and practice obedience and all the rest of it? Why should they do that? It stands to reason to me that the only answer to that question is that if you subscribe to the idea that government's number one obligation is to protect property, the sanctity of property as a right, then the only way that you can expect to receive community support is if you are willing to endorse the freedom of individuals without property to acquire it. And if you do that, if you do agree to that, then you are agreeing to certain limitations. You are agreeing that for a few people to monopolize all the property so that there's nothing left for anybody else would jeopardize the very existence of the community itself. It would jeopardize the Commonwealth. The only conclusion you can reach is that management of the Commonwealth by government, government's responsibility is not only to protect the property from aggression by those who don't have property. Government's responsibility is not only to protect the nation from foreign aggression, which threatens everybody's life, liberty, and property, but government has an equal responsibility to those without property. Government has a responsibility to the community at large. Government has a responsibility to make sure that there is opportunity available to everybody and that it is not owned or monopolized by the few at the expense of the many. Government has an obligation to preserve what some philosophers have referred to as the commons. Government has a responsibility to make sure that there is opportunity available for everybody else. Examples? Why do you think that Jefferson was so excited about the potential of the available to Americans in the Louisiana Purchase? Why do you think that by doubling the size of the continental United States in the Louisiana Purchase, Jefferson believed that he was securing peace and order and security in the Republic for generations to come? Because he was making it possible for there to be enough property, enough opportunity for generations of Americans and immigrants and everything else. In other words, America would become the land of the free because of the opportunities available to those who enjoyed their freedom. Freedom without opportunity is no freedom at all. What good is it? It's worth nothing. So I would suggest to you that inherent in John Locke is government's responsibility not only to protect the property of those who own it, but also to protect the commons, the availability and access of property to those who don't yet have it. The peace and security and literally the future of the Commonwealth depends on the management of the commons by government. I would suggest to you that we are experiencing in modern America, in this day and age, in the year 2013, we are experiencing a situation where those who have browbeaten us into this idea of freedom and property ownership and the sanctity of property and the idea that if you overtax success, you are limiting the freedom and the opportunities that is America. In doing that, we are allowing government to make deals, private deals with entrepreneurs and corporations that are literally putting a price tag on the commons. We are allowing government to stand back and not manage the commons, but rather to make it available to the highest bidder, which are the people with the most property. We are allowing the few to buy up the commons and potentially destroy the freedom and the opportunity of the rest of us. We are allowing government to stand back and allow the few to literally destroy the potential and the future of this republic. And we can no longer put up with it. It is not an accident, for example, that if you look through American history, the number one priority under the Confederation period, in fact, most history books will say the major success of the Confederation government before the Constitution was the organization of the Western Territories, the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, which basically laid out the ground rules for how territories would become, how territories would organize and how they would apply for statehood and how they would enter the Union as states and how their citizens would have the same rights as other citizens. That's considered to be one of the major successes of the Confederation period. One of the major clauses in Article 4 of the Constitution gives the federal government the right to manage and control, to make all needful rules and regulations respecting the properties and territories of the United States. The role of government is to manage the territories, is to manage the commons, is to manage the process whereby private property is acquired and then protected by government. And in order to do it, in order to preserve the future of the republic, government's responsibility is to make sure that the commons is preserved, not sold to the highest bidder, not made a commodity, not basically assigned a price tag. What do we see instead? We are seeing government not only standing back and letting this happen, but actually being compliant in it, to participating in it. We have allowed our coal, our oil, our water, our mountains, our rivers, our streams, literally our air, to be bought and sold as if it were an entrepreneurial commodity on the open market. We are allowing the commons to be destroyed for short-term profit in the interest of the long-term benefit of the republic. We are literally jeopardizing the opportunity and the future of this republic and the citizens who live within it. We are relegating the republic to a commonwealth in which a relatively few control everything and in which the many control less and less and less and less. The numbers are out there. They're everywhere. The media has them. The Washington Post has them. The, you know, the books by Stiglitz and all the rest of them are laying out exactly what is happening in our society. The fact of the matter is the commons is being dismantled and destroyed, and government is complicit in that. We cannot allow that to continue happening. It is not an accident that key features of our greatest cities, the Boston Commons in Boston, Central Park in New York, Lincoln Park in Chicago, and on, the idea that in the organization and creation of our major cities, there is a place reserved for everybody. There is a commons. There is a place where everybody can go. There is a place that everybody owns, because this is the basis of the opportunity that the security and stability of our society must depend upon. In ancient Rome, the Latin term was res publica, public things, the public things. In the medieval period, the medieval manor used to put aside the commons, would set aside land that was available to everybody. Everybody had the right to farm it, to produce crops, to market the crops, and to live off what they were able to produce with their own hands on the commons until they were able to acquire their own property. In other words, all the property was not put up for sale, because if you did that, you would destroy the basis of peace and order in society. You would literally obliterate the basis of what we call the Commonwealth. And throughout our history, government's role, the federal government's role respecting the territories. I mean, I can mention this on, chapter and verse. Lincoln's position about whether slavery had a right to go into the territories. Dred Scott's argument that because, even though he was a slave, he had resided for a time in the territories, in free territory, that made him a free man. Lincoln's position that slavery ought not to be allowed to expand into the territories. The debate over the acquisition of the Philippines and Cuba and Guam and many of the other offshore overseas possessions of the United States in the late 19th and early 20th century was based on the idea, will the Philippines, will Guam, will Hawaii, will Cuba, will these be territories of the United States? Will they come into the Union as states? Will their residents become citizens of the United States? Will they have the same rights under the Constitution of the United States that people who are born and live here have? These were the kinds of relevant questions that have dominated American history throughout its existence. All of them based on the fact that there will be a community, there will be a commons, there will be territory that the people own. And government's responsibility as the agent of the people, government's responsibility to the consent of the governed, is to preserve the commons, not sell it off, not sell it to the highest bidder, not let private corporations buy it or own it. They own the water, they own the minerals in the Gulf, they own the offshore lands, they own everything. They own the timber, they own the coal, they own the oil, they own the gas, they own everything. We are basically denying the existence of the commons. Why? Part of it goes all the way back to the 50s. We were so paranoid about communism that we couldn't even handle, we were willing to call those communists who talked about cooperation. Never mind common ownership of the people in the hands of government. That was pure socialism. That was communism. What we did is we poisoned the nation and the people of the nation against the idea of community, against the idea of commonwealth, against the idea of common ownership, and in the process we relegated what ought to have been the commons. We put it in the market and put a price tag on it and made it available to the common bidder, and as we stand back and look, we are seeing the results. As fewer and fewer people own more and more and more and more of the wealth that is America. And if we don't stop it, we will ultimately destroy the peace and security of the Commonwealth. There will not be a republic. John Locke recognized this when he defined the process whereby man left the state of nature and entered into organized society and created government. Yes, government's job is to protect private property, but it is also to protect the right of citizens without property to acquire it. Not only that, but individual citizens have a responsibility to each other to help them in that process as well. Because we are all children of God, we are all equal, we all have rights, and we are all brothers. We have got to begin to make the reforms that make that happen. When we do, we will reach the potential of what American exceptionalism is all about. We are at 56 minutes after the hour, and I'm going to kind of break it here and let Bob Kincaid set up for the start of his program as well. I want to thank you for an absolutely wonderful, wonderful time together this week. We're going to, again, we will be posting Madison's documents on the PrismWV.org website. But I encourage you, if you just want to go and Google these yourself, just Google Madison's Federalist Number 10 and Madison's Vices of the American Political System, and we'll be focusing on those in a little bit of detail, kind of like we did with John Locke today. I hope you've enjoyed today's program. I hope it's been worthwhile for you. It sure has been for me. I live this stuff, and I find it absolutely exhilarating that I have the opportunity to share it with other people. Again, my email address, waobrien906@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. I look forward to hearing from you on the phone in future programs. We can begin to discuss these things. I don't want too much information to be out there before we begin to exchange ideas and opinions back and forth. For the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution, for myself, Bill O'Brien, for the Head On Radio Network, for Bob Kincaid and his folks, I hope the rest of your week is pleasant. By all means, make it safe, because we want you back with us again. This is Bill O'Brien. Thank you so much for listening.